Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
The Weekend Warrior, every Saturday morning from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m.
on ESPN LA 710.
Dedicated to you, the fan who works hard all week and slugs it out on the court, the field, the big box store, and the honey-do list all weekend long. And helping you cope as you come to the realization you're not 19 any longer. Here's board-certified orthopedic surgeon Dr. Robert Clapper.
Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. I'm so excited. At 8:15, calling in from Idaho is a legend in the world of surfing, which I love so much. He's not only one of the first guys to surf Waimea Bay with Greg Nolan in 1957, but he became one of the greatest shapers of surfboards. And he's also an innovator in terms of the art world and what he put on his T-shirts and surfboards. It's kind of like Michelangelo. Three circles that touched each other. Michelangelo was an architect, he was a painter, and he was a sculptor. Bing Copeland, my guest calling in at 8:15, is a surfer, a shaper, and an artist. I just am so excited to talk to him. But I want to play you a soundbite from an interview he had, which made me think all week about today's topic and today's show. So many things happened to Bing Copeland in his 85 years, but how did it all start? How did the ocean, how did surfing touch his heart? Well, he grew up on 9th and Highland in Manhattan Beach, California, literally a block away from where I sculpt. And he went out for the baseball team like every boy seems to be destined to. And this is what happened at 3 o'clock on a sunny afternoon in Manhattan Beach, baseball practice in the 1950s at MiraCosta High School to Bing Copeland. Let's play that.
I remember I went out for baseball at MiraCosta High School, I was left-handed. I wanted to be a first baseman. And about the fourth or fifth day of tryouts and stuff, I remember looking up at the flag at the school and was blowing offshore at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I went, I got to get out of here. So I went back to the beach. And they definitely, we weren't, we would run around barefoot all the time and let our hair grow a little too long. And we were not widely accepted in those days.
Cupid shot an arrow into his heart when he saw the wind change. When he saw that wind change, his life changed, and he knew the course he had to be on. And it made me think all week, okay, when the wind of change occurs, I love the world of sports, the world of art, the world of surgery. Where do we see that? Well, the greatest song in my lifetime written about wind was written by two guys. One wrote the music, the composer, Frederick Lowe, and the lyricist was Alan J. Lerner. 1951, they wrote a musical called Paint Your Wagon. They also wrote My Fair Lady and Camelot and Gigi and many others. Oscars, Tony Awards. These guys are the greatest duo. Rodgers and Hammerstein, Lerner and Lowe, right up there. Mount Rushmore of making the great American musical. Here's the song they call The Wind Mariah.
Way out here, they got a name for rain and wind and fire. The rain is Tess, the fire is Joe, and they call the wind Mariah. Mariah blows the stars around and sends a cloud.
They wrote many of these musicals
Mariah
in the same fashion.
Like
first, the title would come when they look at the play. And then Fred Lowe would make the music. And then Alan J. Lerner would write the lyrics. Back and forth they worked. Almost like working a surfboard blank to create a surfboard. Camelot, one of their biggest hits. The star was Robert Goulet, Bobby Goulet. Let's listen to Robert Goulet singing his part as Lancelot in Camelot. Let's hear that.
If ever I would leave you, it wouldn't be in summer. Seeing you in summer, I never would go.
How did he get this job? Also, the wind chants. Now let's listen to Maurice Chevalier singing in another play that they wrote, musical, Gigi.
Thank heaven for little girls. Get bigger every day.
And you may ask yourself, why is he playing this? Now let's listen to Lerner and Lowe talking about, just like that flag for Bing Copeland changed direction and became offshore, the moment, the wind of change, the wind of chance for Robert Goulet and for Maurice Chevalier. They may not have been surfers, they were actors, but they had to change their lives on a moment. Let's listen, one and two, the Broadway of Lerner and Lowe.
Listening to Bobby, Fritz and I were just talking about the capriciousness of chance in a theatrical career.
Yes, take the case of Bobby. It was a matter of 5 minutes. We were about to leave for Europe to look for Lancelot for Camelot.
We thought we'd seen everyone on this side of the ocean.
5 minutes before we left the office, an agent called and pleaded with us to listen to Bobby. A matter of 5 minutes.
Yes, and so a theatrical career began. Maurice Chevalier was telling us that he was singing in a little cafe in Paris for nothing when an old professional just happened to overhear him and suggested the audition for a local music hall. He did, and he got his first professional job.
Incidentally, do you happen to know when that was? In 1901.
Yes, and with that audition, I suppose, began one of the most amazing theatrical careers of our time.
And even more amazing, Alan, after 60 years, he still is eager and enthusiastic as he must have been the day he began.
You know, that audition occurred in 1901 to Maurice Chevalier, which incidentally is the very year Frederick Lerner was born, or Frederick Lowe was born. All right, let's go to more. How these guys met is also happenstance, the wind of change. These two greats, Alan J. Lerner, Frederick Lowe, let's listen how they first met each other. The Alan J. Lerner and Tony Thomas interview, 1-6.
Mr. Lerner, you said a little while ago you met Fritz Lowe, Frederick Lowe. Well, that's a simplification. I mean, how do you meet a man with whom you're going to do such marvelous work?
Well, I suppose the stars were looking down on us that day. I was in the Lambs Club, which is an actors and writers club in New York City. And as I was on the way to the to wash my hands, actually, Fritz Lowe was sitting at a table in the restaurant, and he said, stopped me, and he said, say, you write lyrics, don't you? And I said, yes. I did 2 years ago at college. And he said, well, I don't have a lyricist. Do you want to write with me? Well, I didn't even know who he was. I just said yes. So probably because I thought anybody who was a member of the Lambs Club must be a genius, you see. Well, I didn't realize he was. And we started working together just like that. So we met that afternoon and started
wow.
to work.
Well, it sounds feasible.
Yes. Not believable, but that's exactly the way it happened.
It was one of the happiest meetings in theatrical history because the two of you seemed to get along professionally, splendidly. I mean, well, the music and the lyrics were just a marvelous combination.
Well, we were together 18 years, so that's quite a hunk out of everybody's life.
The question to ask is, why did you stop?
Well, we stopped, unfortunately, because Fritz, in 1958, had a massive coronary. And he had a very bad heart attack. And he decided he would try once more with Camelot. But he was terribly concerned about his health, as well he should be. And he's older than I am. He's 17 years older than I am.
But he outlives him.
And he, you see, well, I'm going to interrupt myself. There are two kinds of composers, in a way. There are those who compose with their fingers, in other words, who improvise, and those who sort of compose in their head, the way Kurt Weill, let's say, did. Well, Fritz was a finger composer. He sat at the piano, and he really sweated it out.
At the piano effort.
And he was afraid that the passion that he put into composing was a strain on his heart. Now, whether it is or was or not, is immaterial, because as long as he thought so, that could do the damage. And I think with good logic, he said to himself, why should I go through this, and why should I agonize? And it would have deprived him of all the joy of creating. And so he decided to retire, and that was the reason we stopped working together.
It's a matter of life or death.
Exactly.
Just like Bing Copeland is going to sculpt from a blank the most beautiful surfboard, making the beautiful end result the shape, the same thing is true for these guys in the art world. They've got to start with a blank piece of paper, put words and music on. But what if the singer for your Broadway musical is Rex Harrison, and he can't sing, he can just act? Then you've got to make the music for him, where there's no sustained notes. He's a non-singer. It's almost like a rap song, My Fair Lady. Listen to their process. This is like talking to Bing Copeland about how he shapes a surfboard. Let's listen to playback, 1 through 5.
Once it was determined in our own minds that the character of Higgins called for an actor rather than a singer, then it became primarily a musical problem.
Yes, in other words, instead of writing a baritone solo for Professor Higgins, the music had to be written in such a way that a non-singer could sing it. In other words, no sustained notes. I'd love to show it to you.
All right, let's see.
Well, Alan found the title, I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face. Now, if I had written this, the music like this, I've grown accustomed to her face, he could never have sustained it. So I wrote it the other way, sure.
I've grown accustomed to her face. In other words, it was set exactly the way one speaks it.
With a normal drop.
With a normal drop in the voice. Yeah. And all the songs that Higgins sang in the play were all written in the same way.
Hmm. Well, now, you said just now that that Alan gave you the title. Is that the way you create together?
You always start with the title, and then I give the title to Fritz. Fritz writes the music to the title, knowing the dramatic intent. And after he is finished, then I write the lyrics to the music.
Well, what happens if you ever get the wrong title? Do you get it?
Yes.
Oh, frequently.
Very often. At the wrong song, the wrong place.
Oh, yes, we go all the way through. We not only get the wrong title, but then we write the wrong song to go with it. Yes. Gigi, for example, in the title song Gigi, we originally written a song called She's Too Young for Me. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
We went ahead. I don't remember the lyrics now. We wrote the whole
She's Too Young for Me. Much too young.
And we discovered that was wrong dramatically, and then wrote the song Gigi. Am I a fool without a mind? In which he discovers that the child has grown up.
Did Gigi serve the same purpose that the other song was supposed to do?
Yes, but it served it more accurately.
I see.
Dramatically.
I see.
Now here came the title on the third line. Oh no, if ever I would leave you. And I took that home to write and discovered that I couldn't always reach the climax on the third line dramatically. So then Fritz rewrote it and made the title come first, so I would start with the title and then build to a climax each time. If ever I would leave you, it wouldn't be in summer. How I'd leave in summer, I never would know. Your hair streaked with sunlight.
You can just hear the passion and the love they have for their work. And every time they say Gigi, I can't help but think about Kobe and his daughter. What about in sports? Wind. Being able to turn on a dime. There's nobody who ever did it better than Robbie Nash. 23 world championships in windsurfing. He does everything. Kite surfing, foil surfing, wing surfing. His whole life is about the wind and the water. He started at 13 years old. His parents put him on a plane from Hawaii to Puerto Rico, and he won the championship at 13. Crazy. Listen to Robbie Nash, who knows about wind and water better than anybody else. And the key is to be adaptable. Let's do 1 through 6, Robbie Nash.
Yeah, wind and water are a great combination. I basically grew up playing with both of those. Was lucky enough to somehow find a career path that included them. And they're two elements that, for what I do, are incredibly three-dimensional, always changing, adaptable. You know, I've been able to sort of evolve my career through the decades, playing with wind and waves in different ways, whether it's windsurfing and all those aspects, kiting in its various aspects, going into foiling and SUP and whatnot. But wind especially is just, it's one of those things you can't control. It's always changing. It's a variable that it's tangible, but not really. Not really. And it keeps things interesting. You know, it's an environment that always challenges you. You're never going to perfect it, no matter how much you practice. Doing what we do, you're always going to make mistakes. You're always going to get the unexpected. And it keeps life interesting. Basically being a kid and playing and getting up and falling down and learning something new and falling down. And again, being in an environment that's so safe. If I were an extreme athlete in any other sport, I would be long gone. You know, my body would have fallen apart ages ago. I fall into the water, you know, at pretty low speeds from relatively low heights. And, you know, until pretty recently, never even hurt myself. You know, knocked my teeth out, lots of cuts and bruises, but minor things compared to almost any other sport. When I broke my pelvis kiting 3 years ago, that was the first real injury I ever had. It was a bad one, but it took a long time to get there. If you're a skateboarder, a motocross, freestyle, I mean, you could just name almost any other sport. That is almost a guarantee, that kind of thing, and often. Wind is a great element to be able to be creative with, especially when water is the element that you're falling into. So I'm pretty lucky. Sometimes a wipeout in a really big wave is easier than a wipeout in a smaller wave, because you just become part of this mass of water. And there's some violent tumbling and turning kind of at the end of it. It's more not being able to breathe. The wipeout is fine. You know you're not going to, like, get ripped apart. It's just sometimes really wishing you could get a breath earlier than you can. My only close call at Jaws was just being held down so long that I almost blacked out. And that sucked. I don't want to do that again. But otherwise, big waves and water are sometimes just this methodical, almost, it just, everything slows down, and it's calmer than, like, wiping out in a double overhead wave where you get pounded and bottom violently, you know, busted off the bottom. And so, yeah, big waves are sometimes not so bad.
That's the great Robbie Nash talking about the adaptability that he must be to deal with wind. The adaptability that Bing Copeland had seeing the wind change and knew the ocean was calling. And the adaptability that Lerner and Lowe recognizes in the theater to be able to make from a blank piece of paper the song, the music, and how you must turn on a dime and change. Because if Rex Harrison can't sing, you better write the song in a different way. The world of art, the world of sports, the world of surgery, what wind teaches us. Coming up next, we're going to learn all about what wind has taught and created one of the greatest lives in surfing. The great Bing Copeland is joining me. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show here on 710 ESPN.
Check this out. Weekend Warrior is on the air.
From the epicenter of sports in the Southland.
ESPN LA 710. With Dr. Robert Clapper, board-certified orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai Health Associates.
Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. I'm so excited. Joining me now, calling in from Idaho, is the great Bing Copeland. Bing, thanks so much for getting up early to be with us. I'm so excited.
Well, good morning to you, Robbie. It's actually, it's an hour later here in Idaho, so I've had my breakfast and my coffee, and I'm ready to go.
Speaking of ready to go, Bing Copeland, where did the creativity come to call you Bing? I've never met anybody with that first name before. Where does that come from?
Well, I was born Herbert Bingham Copeland III.
My father was
the second. My grandfather was the first. So my middle name was Bingham. And when I was 2 years old, babysitters didn't want to call me Herbie. So they shortened my middle name and called me Bing. And it's been that way ever since.
Oh, my God. You know, our paths have crossed without crossing. So, you know, I sculpted marble in the stone that Michelangelo used in his quarry, the same exact stone. And my studio is on 10th Street and Highland in Manhattan Beach. And you'll see blocks of stone out there right now if you were to walk there. And you grew up literally a block away, right?
Exactly. 9th and Highland. 814 Highland, to be exact.
And here's another one. When you went to Waikiki and Honolulu in the late 50s, you lived on Lili O'Kalani Street. Well, in 1983, when I went to Hawaii to work at Queens Hospital for the very first time, my fourth year of medical school, I did a rotation. I lived on Lili O'Kalani Street. It's amazing that I'm just so happy to be able to talk to you. Now,
it was 1955 when I went to, when I was there.
Oh, my God. You know, I don't really use the term often, but I'm going to. The whole idea and why I'm so obsessed with Michelangelo and when he used to go into the quarry and pick the stone that he wanted to use. No other sculptor ever did this. His designation when he would mark the block of stone he wanted was he would draw three circles that interlock, kind of like how the Olympic signal is. And it meant the three circles. He's in the guild for architect, for painter, and for sculptor. And when I think of you, you truly remind me of Michelangelo as a surfer, a shaper, and as an artist. Is it not lost on you the metaphor of surfing for life, that the nose of the board is the future, the tail of the board is your past, and the surfer stands in the middle and learns to live in the moment? Tell me about the metaphor of surfing in life.
That's a long one. for me, surfing, I just started when I was 13, 14 years old. And to get into the surfboard business was just a natural progression because I grew up around Dale Velsey, who basically was one of the first board builders in California. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from him. And it was when I did come back, well, I went to Hawaii for a couple of years to be in the Coast Guard, and then I sailed on a yacht for another year. But in 1959, I started my surfboard business. So being in the ocean, being near the ocean, surfing was all that I really wanted to do. And my other option was probably to get a real job on the other side of Pacific Coast Highway, and I didn't want to go that far east.
I'd love to ask you this one question, Bing Copeland, that I've always thought about, and it was told to me by a Hawaiian friend of mine. And tell me if this makes sense. He said, if you take a blank of the two blanks of the same height and you build a board the same length, the same width, the same thickness, the same dimensions, and you then glass those two boards, you take them out in the ocean, they are going to ride slightly differently. Is that true?
Well, yeah, it depends on the rails, the bottom contour and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Basically the same length, same width, same thickness will probably float about the same, but they definitely won't ride the same if they don't have the proper characteristics in the fin and the rails and so forth.
So again, I'm going to use the Michelangelo metaphor with you, Bing Copeland, because I just think you are that great. One of the rare moments in Michelangelo's life, his biographer visited him in his studio, and he didn't really let people into the studio, and they didn't suffer fools very well. The biographer, Vasari, said he watched him work feverishly, hitting the marble with such force, pieces 3 to 4 times the size of a typical sculptor came flying off the face, like critical error. He makes one mistake, it's ruined. And Vasari said he blurted out, "Michelangelo, how do you know when to stop?" And Michelangelo turned to him and said, "When you hit the skin." So I want to ask you, Bing Copeland, do you see the finished product when you begin with the skill saw shaping the blank? Can you get to the point where you see it before it even is taken off?
Well, you definitely start with an idea in your mind that you want to achieve. And and you whittle away till you get to that vision that you had. So that's as far as designing a new model or something like that, that would be the way. Just shaping generally, a shaper, you know, will have a certain model and he wants to shape it the same every time. But to me, it's more fun to be inventive with new designs and new shapes. That was what I enjoyed the most about shaping surfboards.
Did you have a favorite part of the process of shaping the surfboard?
Not really. Just seeing your vision come out in the end is what's important.
You know, you're one of the few people who made the transition. You know, you started your life. You know, Rebecca, let's play the soundbite of Bing speaking. I would like to hear. Now I have the person who's talking actually can almost editorialize what he's hearing. Let's play the soundbite for Bing.
I remember I went out for baseball at Maricosta High School, went out for baseball, and I was left-handed. I wanted to be a first baseman, and about the fourth or fifth day of tryouts and stuff, I remember looking up at the flag at the school and was blowing offshore at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I went, I got to get out of here. So I went back to the beach, and they definitely... we weren't, we would run around barefoot all the time and let our hair grow a little too long, and we were not widely accepted in those days.
Bing, you remember that day when it called to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. It was a hot day. It was a Santa Ana wind blowing offshore, and I knew my buddies were all surfing. And the tide was right, and I was trying to be a first baseman and realized that I definitely wouldn't be first string. I would be sitting on the bench, so I'd rather be in the ocean. So that was my choice.
So I heard that and was just so impressed with how you knew immediately. Can you take me to the other extreme when you realized you weren't going to surf anymore? Towards the end, when you were 75 and the last wave. You remember the first wave? You remember the last wave?
I remember them both. Yes, I do, very much so. The last wave, I was in Baja. I had a home in Baja at the time, which I just sold recently last fall. And I was surfing a little spot that just south of our home in Baja. That was fun little beach break spot. And at that point, at 75, I was having trouble getting to my feet. I couldn't pop up like you should. And so consequently, if I couldn't get to my feet in time, I would just belly slide. And I was actually I was having a lot of fun belly sliding. It waved overhead, and it felt great. Anyway, this one wave, I was just going in towards the beach, and I could see I was getting close to the to the beach, and there were some rocks, and I thought, well, I better do a little island pullout, which is burying the nose of the board and spinning the tail around and get out of the way. And I tried to bury it two or three times. It didn't go. Finally, I washed up on the beach, and it broke the nose off the board. And I just said to myself, this is it. I'm done. That was my last wave. And I don't regret it. I honestly don't. I've talked to several friends, Hap Jacobs, John McFarland, guys that are a little older than me, that also hung it up at one time or another. And they just said, well, I quit when it just wasn't fun anymore. And it's not only that, but you start having some physical limitations that keep you from being agile enough to jump to your feet and turn and have fun on the board. And it's, you just realize it's time. I do talk to some guys, I call them younger guys, the guys in their 50s and 60s, and tell them this story, about how I quit and why I quit and stuff. And they go, oh, I'm never going to quit. So I die. And I know better.
Yeah. Listen, can you hang on the line a second? I want to talk to you about the mountains versus the ocean and the whole new life you have. But then you were reborn again and what that was like. Can you just hang on a second? We're just going to pay some bills and get back to the interview.
Sure.
Okay, I love it. We're talking to the great Bing Copeland, a Mount Rushmore icon in the world of surfing and shaping surfboards. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show here on 710 ESPN.
Check this out. Weekend Warrior is on the air.
From the epicenter of sports in the Southland.
ESPN LA 710. With Dr. Robert Clapper, board-certified orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai Health Associates.
Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. We're so delighted to be able to talk to the great Bing Copeland. Bing, you spent the time in 1974, you leave the surf and you move to Idaho and create a successful business there. When I'm in the ocean, waiting for the waves, these bumps in the ocean to come, and then I look up because I surf in Ventura at the mountains in front of me, on some level, I almost feel like it's the same. There's a mountain of water. There's a mountain of dirt. That there's a wave. It's a frozen wave, and that's what a mountain is. What was it like to transition in your life from having 24/7 the ocean and surfing to now being in the mountains?
Well, it was a matter of necessity at the time. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much that I did it for the mountains themselves. I did it because the surfboard industry was at that time was going into the tank, mm-hmm. and I really had to do something different. Mm-hmm. So, this was as the boards were getting shorter, very short actually, and it was also happened to be the hippie era and the drug era in California, which led me to think I'd like to live in a smaller town. Mm-hmm. My business was a bit dwindling because the older guys that were paying the full price for surfboards, a lot of them were quitting because they didn't want to ride short boards. So there wasn't enough business. I had a big factory and a lot of employees, and I could see it in the handwriting on the wall that it wasn't going to continue to be a successful business. So I contacted a friend in Idaho, actually, who used to work with me, was my sales manager for years. Mm-hmm. And he had a business up there, and I moved up and became a partner with him. And that's turned out very well for both of us. But that's the reason I did it. There was no other reason other than it was a necessity.
I just love when I study your life, how, as a surgeon, how important art is to me. And what I love about your journey is how important art seemed to be for you as well. And I had the privilege of taking care of Bruce Brown, did shoulder surgery on him, and we became very close friends. And I noticed recently that the iconic poster, The Endless Summer, made by John Hammersfeld, you also worked with him in your poster designs. So tell us about Bruce Brown. Tell us about John Hammersfeld and how much art played a role in your life.
Well, when I had my very first shop on the Strand in Hermosa Beach, right by the pier, John Van Hammersfeld was a young surfer at that time, and he and his crew, most of the Haggerty Surf Club members and stuff like that, became customers of mine. And John, actually, he did the poster as an ad for the magazine. For he was I guess editor or art director of International Surfing, was it, or Surfing Illustrated, one of those two. And so that's where that poster came from. But it was originally an ad. But he did this prior to doing the Endless Summer poster. So he kind of talks about it starting him into the poster business. So I feel honored about that. John was
you were there for the beginning of everything. How about Bruce Brown?
Bruce Brown, I've known Bruce Brown, all through the years, but we were never real close. But a great guy. I always respected him and enjoyed his films for sure.
Now, take us back to 1957 with Greg Knoll, the first day at Waimea. I got to ask you this question, because I ask this of every surfer I have on the show, from Jerry Lopez to, I had Greg and Jed Knoll on in the past as well, Sean Thompson. Tell us about the close calls. You're surfing Waimea Bay in 1957. Have you ever said to yourself, uh-oh, I'm down too long, this may be it for me?
No, I never really had that feeling.
I enjoyed
bigger waves. I enjoyed big waves. When we went in 1955 to 57, we spent a lot of time at Makaha. And luckily we got there, we surfed in California, so we were young, 19 years old. We were in good shape. And we were good swimmers, because in those days we didn't have leashes. If you lose your board, you had to swim. So everybody had pretty good survival swimming skills. But I remember surfing Makaha when it started. We started surfing at about 6 foot, and a day or two later, it got a little bigger. And so we worked our way up, and we eventually were riding 20-foot waves at Makaha. But the thing that I liked about the larger waves is the slowness. It's just like, it was a takeoff and a long drop. If you look down the line, if you see it's going to close out, you straighten your board out, you'd shoot way out in front of the wave, and it just seemed like it took forever. You could lay down, and then the white water would catch up with you and just kind of envelop you, and then you come popping out of it, bouncing. These were on bigger boards. These were balsa boards in those days. Velzy 9'6" surfboards. So
when you shaped the boards, did you play music, or did you prefer to be in silence?
I was always in silence, although some of my employees that shaped enjoyed music. But I always liked to just concentrate on what I was doing. Music was not a part of my shaping, for sure.
This is my last question, Bing. I could talk to you for hours. Now that you look back on your life, for the young folks, what kind of message would you give someone? Like, what should you do with your life? Do you find the passion? Do you follow the wind in whichever way it blows you? What would be your meaning of life or your journey for life?
I would say just follow your passion and go the way the wind blows. Just do what just seems to come natural, and enjoy the trip, because I never really planned my future. I just sort of lived every day as it came to me, and it's worked out well for me. So I don't know how else to say that, but just to follow the line and do what you want to do, and hopefully you enjoy it.
You know, we can all learn from this. You've had a blessed life, but the most important thing is you appreciate the blessing that it is. It's exactly the way Vince Scully speaks as well. He still feels like he's the luckiest guy in the world and aw shucks about it. And you're the same way. Bean Coblen, it's such a pleasure. Listen, you now have an orthopedic surgeon in your family, me, if you ever need me. And I sure appreciate you joining us today. You really made our day, particularly with this crazy pandemic going on.
Exactly. Thank you, Robbie. I'm enjoying talking to you from my home in Idaho, overlooking the mountains. It's peaceful and calm. There's no cars on the road because of this virus thing. And it's pretty enjoyable. Thanks very much for having me.
Okay. Stay safe, Bean Coblen, and God bless you. All right, Warriors, coming up next, the clinic will be open. The number is 877-710-ESPN. What a pleasure to be able to talk to one of my heroes, the great Bean Coblen, on 710 ESPN.
Check this out. Weekend Warrior is on the air.
From the epicenter of sports in the Southland.
ESPN LA 710. With Dr. Robert Clapper, board-certified orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai Health Associates.
Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. That's the great Bob Seger. Against the Wind. What a great show to talk about how the winds of change, the winds of chance, and you got to be ready for it. Bean Coblen, he followed the wind, and what a career. Benefited so many people, thousands of surfboards later. What a great story. But it's the same in art. It's the same in sports. And for me, it was the same in surgery. I knew I wanted to work with my hands, but I had no idea I was going to be an orthopedic surgeon. I didn't know what they did. And I'm sitting in a lecture hall at Columbia University, 1980. Wow, that's a long time ago, 40 years ago. Damn. I'm sitting in the lecture hall, and in walks the chief of orthopedic surgery at Columbia, Dr. Frank Stinchfield, one of the first men to bring hip surgery, a hip replacement, from England to America. I didn't know what a legend he was at all. And I'm sitting in my chair. To my left is a nice young fellow who wants to be a pediatrician. And to my right, sitting next to me, is another person who wants to be a psychiatrist. Nothing wrong with that. And I'm sitting there going, I have no idea what I want to be, but I know I want to be a carpenter. I want to use my hands. It's going to be some kind of surgery. That's what I knew. And then all of a sudden, Frank Stinchfield puts up an x-ray, a pelvis x-ray, where there's no hip, there's no ball and socket joint. It never fully formed. And he says, this person was born with a congenitally dislocated hip, because it wasn't life-threatening. They got to live their whole life limping as a child, as a teenager, but still was able to grow to be an adult, but can no longer walk. And he presents this case in this big lecture hall. Then all of a sudden he says, and Gladys, please come on in here. He brings a woman, beautifully dressed in a salsa dressing outfit, salsa dancing outfit. And she does these pirouettes dancing down in the lecture hall. I'm indoors, but I got to tell you, it felt like someone opened up the window, and just like Bean Coblen saw the flag fly offshore from the Santa Ana winds, the wind came into my heart. Because I watched this lady dancing, and I put two and two together and realized, oh my God, this lady is dancing, and she was born with that hip. Frank Stinchfield clicks the slide projector, and the next x-ray is of a prosthesis, and he rebuilt her hip. He said she didn't have a socket, so I made one. When I cut the ball off of what was left of her femur, never really fully formed, I used that bone of hers. And by the way, the first thing he said was, I used a saw to cut the bone. And I'm going, saw? Nobody ever told me I could use a saw like my father, the carpenter. He said, then I bolted. I drilled with a drill into the pelvis. And I put screws through the bone. And I made a shelf when there was no shelf in her pelvis so that I can sculpt and create under the shelf a brand new socket with coverage. I'm sitting there going, he used a saw, he used a drill, he used a screwdriver, he used screws. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God, the wind now is blowing through the room. And Cupid came flying in and shot me in the heart and said, Robbie, this is what you're going to do. Just like Bing Copeland said, I'm not going to play baseball. I want to be out there with those waves that this offshore wind is doing. Just like Robert Goulet and Maurice Chevalier, just on the moment, 5 minutes, just like Alan J. Lerner and Fritz Lowe say, they were ready to leave, but they stayed. And in that 5 minutes, Robert Goulet became a star. Otherwise, who knows what? It would have been another career that never happened. The wind of change, the wind of chance, but you do have to be open for it. Listening to Robbie Nash, the greatest windsurfer of all time, talk about the three-dimensional nature of wind and water, the gentleness of landing in the water. He also broke his pelvis doing it, by the way. Not that gentle. But the adaptability that you must be to deal with the winds of change. I think that's the message. You have to be open for the wind that's going to change on a dime. And be adaptable. Listening to Bing Copeland, he's not a person who's going to have all kinds of highs and lows in his voice. But I'm here to tell you, what that man did to the entire world of surfing is more than the aw shucks. I kind of just did this and I did that and I did this. But he made major advances in every aspect of that sport. Just a blessing to be able to talk to a man in his mid-80s like that. Thanks so much for joining me today. Next week, my guest is going to be Natasha Trentacosta, who's a doctor, who's an orthopedic surgeon at Curl and Job, whose specialty is kids. Growth plates are still in. And being a woman, she really enjoys taking care of women athletes. What a whole unique perspective that's going to be. It's really going to be fun for me to teach you all about what happens when you do injure yourself and you're still growing. The growth plate, we have to be very, very cognizant of that because we can do a beautiful surgery, but if we mess up the ability for the child's leg to still grow, then one leg becomes longer than the other, which is a disaster. And yet, if you tore your ACL and you're 12 years old, what do we do? This is the kind of conversation I want to have next week. Until then, stay safe and home. Make the salad with red wine vinegar that I told you about. The bowl of salad is not made of wood anymore where you rub the garlic into it. So I just chop up the garlic finely. But when you drink that red wine vinegar with the garlic in it, think of me. Until next week, I'll see you on the radio. Nel cielo.